All right, so one of the things that Christian didn't say is that I'm not just an electrical engineer, but I was a laser engineer, so, you know, there'll be a little bit of that sort of...
This was too far off.
Yeah. Yes. And I also worked in the aerospace industry, so, you know, this is the most fun I've had in my career, though. All right, so first I'll do an introduction, and then I'll talk, go through self-organization, sort of my view of why we need it. Take some physical analogies and talk about what we might learn from them. Talk about some experiments and then some conclusions. So, you know, being somebody who started out with transistors, digital computation, I mean, at the bottom, what does it do, right? It stores a bit, it reads a bit, it compares a bit. All right? But, you know, we do a lot of that. Okay, we really do a lot of that. And I think what I want to emphasize is, in the first part of this talk, there are a lot of numbers that are the size of a billion. Okay? And so when we think of the problem of managing lots of stuff, we already do a really remarkable job of organizing something. We go to applications, right? And you know, if you look at how many lines of code there are and things that we use all the time, you know, we're still up sort of at 10 to the 7th lines of code, and it works. So, you know, the first part of my message is, you know, actually, computer science is doing pretty well. It's managing really large sizes of little things. But now, you know, we want to aggregate them. We want them to do nice things. And, oh yeah, we want to connect them. And so now we're getting into numbers again of applications, devices, and actions that are up at 10 to the 9th. Okay. So, what's the size of this state space, right? And how do you differentiate that? You know, I mean, do we care anymore whether it's infinite or not? I don't think so. I think you just simply say it's so big that that the complexity really, as Christian said, complexity is in a sense its own technical challenge now. Oh, and it gets even more interesting, right? Because now we're talking about directions like the Internet of Things. So we're talking about connecting all of that complexity to real stuff and managing and making real stuff work. But now, you know, some of the, I mean, bits are bits, and they do what they're gonna do. And we may not like the fact that, for example, we've erased a file and can't get it back. But the consequences of that are annoying. You know, when you start to control, I mean, your refrigerator may not be so bad, but you know, your car, healthcare, some of those sorts of things, you start to really care that you get it right. You know, there isn't a lot of room, and you need new things because now we're having these systems interact with humans, and we really don't have good models of how individual humans want to do things. They're just off the map. We need security. We now suddenly need real-time, locally, frequently, but sometimes also remotely. We want to control things, for example, over the internet, remotely. We worry about identification, authentication, to make a whole bunch of stuff work, some of which doesn't actually even exist yet, that we want to integrate. We have the problem of creating appropriate standards. Standards that are good enough so that we can do what we need to do, but are loose enough so that we don't squeeze out innovation. Okay. And I think that's part of this reasoning. I mean, Christian came at this from a different point of view, which is it's happening. I'm saying, yeah, it happens. But I'm also saying, you know, there's a lot of places where we could think about applying self-organization. Where is that and why? So, space exploration. You know, the road trip lifetime to even a planet is long enough that there's no joystick. And currently, we have these incredibly expensive resources that we send out a long distance, invest time and money and huge amounts of resources, and then we very cautiously experiment back and forth through this long time delay and ask it to do something, upload some stuff, make sure the thing information comes back, make sure that it did it right. So that expensive resource that could do lots more work is actually not being used a fair amount of the time because we have to be so careful with our directions to it. And so I think one of the places that we need better autonomy in decision making is in something like space exploration, where you don't have time to tell it, oh no, don't go there, that looks like a hole to me. You know, don't crash into that wall. The next place that I think is a place that we already have systems operating. We have military and law enforcement robots, robots that go into hostile environments for us, healthcare robots, both surgical robots, and we're starting to have healthcare robots that would assist human beings. So for example, people who are disabled or geriatric. And so these are some of the examples. And you know, you'd really like that the robot that's getting grandpa out of his easy chair doesn't throw him across the room, doesn't crush his hand, and actually understands when grandpa reaches out that he needs to get out of his chair. So these are, you know, sometimes they're locally controlled, sometimes they're independent, sometimes they're remotely controlled, but all of these things need incredible dependability and security. You know, you don't want somebody else to take over your talent over there, for example. One of the examples that's really central, I think, to some of the efforts in the early organic computing efforts is traffic control. You know, it would be really nice if we could somehow simply control traffic lights and minimize collisions, minimize congestion, minimize delays and extra braking and things for individual drivers, minimize the energy consumption for the transportation networks that we need, and eliminate greenhouse gas emissions. And you know, right now, right, we muddle through. We have a few collisions. It's not optimal. We mostly seem to get where we're going, but I think we all have a feeling that this could be much better. But it requires organization on a variety of scales, sensing, prediction, and organization on a variety of scales. And that means some interesting kinds of modeling and sensing. Another example is the electrical grid. Okay. Reliability is essential. Our society is built on it. So is my presentation, of course. But you know, this is something where previously, you know, this was centrally controlled generation to user. Okay, and it was built on the idea that we had these large, robust generating facilities, whether it was a dam or a boiler or something. And we put sort of the onus on the user to help us control things by charging them for being bad actors on the grid. But we're moving to the place that we would like to integrate a fairly high fraction of unpredictable generation sources, like wind and solar. They're variable on both predictable and unpredictable timescales. Because phase is used to sync the grid, you need to do this on the scale of basically milliseconds, which means that you have to have some local control because the travel time to that central controller now becomes an issue, and predicting it becomes an issue. Generation and consumption are not evenly distributed either geographically or in time. Typically, you have wind farms up somewhere in a pass in the mountains and a city some miles away. And yet, electricity is probably the only economic product that has to be consumed when it's generated, because we don't have storage technologies at the scale of the grid. So part of the vision here is I can put generation, I can put storage technologies, I can distribute them, they're going to be all over, and I still want the whole thing to work. So I have the bottom-up emergence problem. I would really like the right behavior to emerge here. And I need to do it in a way that can integrate new emerging technologies, from smart meters to your refrigerator or your washing machine that will turn on when the cost is low in the middle of the night, things like that. So this is a very large, you know, in principle, at least in the United States, continent-scale geographic system. And by the way, one of the points I want to make about this is an example of, you know, this is something that's really hard to test. You need to get it right the first time, okay? So the bottom line is we need regular, determinate, reproducible behavior. And the reason I put those words in quotes is they go all the way back to Ashby. I mean, this is a goal that's been around for computer science, in a sense, and control systems for a long time. But we need to do that in conditions that were not anticipated at design time. I think that's one of the big points. We want, therefore, our engineered systems to make really good choices, but we want them to do that autonomously, either because we don't have time to tell them, or because we frankly don't know enough to tell them what to do. Complexity is large enough. So we give them embedded computational resources. We have lots of those, and we're putting more and more of those. You know, it used to be, question I used to ask students is, how many microprocessors do you own? Okay? And now my question is, how many microprocessors do you think there are in your car? Okay. But we've learned from experience that we can't always predetermine the link between what the system knows, that is what it senses, what we've allowed it to gather as data, and what we want it to do. So I think that's where self-organization comes in, is that in the past, our systems have been, as Christian said, very top-down. We set requirements, we'd say this is what we want the system to do, we build a system to those requirements, we test it to those requirements, and then we put it out in the world, and something else happens. And so we'd like our systems to make good choices. And so I'll give a couple of physics analogies. Dilute gases. You know, you take N particles and you put them at temperature T and volume V, and if they don't really interact except bouncing off each other, you get pressure, okay? Well, independent of the particles, right? I mean, water vapor and nitrogen do the same thing if there's few enough, but that's if N is large enough, right? Because pressure is an average behavior. And if the particles only interact elastically, and what I didn't put on this slide is, if you wait long enough so that the average means something. Okay. And so one of the questions is, if we want our systems to have these emergent properties, How many collaborating agents do we need to have in order to get these emergent properties and to get them to be stable? The message here is maybe quite a lot. On the other hand, you know, you just change the conditions a little bit and you get fluid dynamics, which is nowhere near as nice. And I think this is my emergence example. So I'd like pressure to emerge, but if I go to fluid dynamics, I get, well, especially, you know, things like the turbulence. And so the same N water molecules in different conditions can do some things that are really, really difficult to understand. Okay, what do I learn from that? Well, the magnitude of n matters. The characteristic time probably matters. And getting the interactions right is critical, because it's the interactions that have something to do with the change there. Okay, so that's how I think about this stuff. Now let me talk a little bit about some of the experiments that we've done. What I set out to do was to build a test bed for these ideas. And my thinking was, you know, simulation means modeling. And models are, by their very nature, summaries, and so they're less complete than the real world. And our design style is that designers are forced to make choices before, I'll quote Chris, designers are forced to make choices before they know enough to make them. Okay? So if you think about, I was once a systems engineer in the aerospace industry, and you know, the beloved block diagram that's in everybody's proposal, right? This is our system configuration, and yet, you know, where you draw the boundaries between one part and another has a huge impact upon the performance of the final system. But we make that up before we really, you know, that's one of the places our requirements come from. And so we make a lot of choices, and unfortunately we make a lot of assumptions. I want to keep that in mind. The choices are what I call deliberate. Many times the assumptions are things that we chose not to think about because, you know what, it's just not our computer systems that we ask to model. We model. Right? We do a very good job of accumulating data and modeling. If you want an example, let's talk about driving to work and driving home. It turns out it's very, very difficult for you to remember any particular day that you, what happened on any particular day that you drove to work or drove home. Why? Well, because they're all very much the same. And so we just kind of lumped them together unless there's something really interesting that happened that day. Okay? So we don't save all the data. We don't save all the detail. And so, in a sense, we're setting a lot of possibilities to zero that aren't really quite zero. And that leads us to make assumptions when we design, especially with stuff that we've used for a while, like software. So, we need to test. But sometimes we're talking here about systems that will eventually include components that don't exist at the design and test time. And the space of possible conditions is larger than we can afford to cover, really. And unfortunately, it's the ones that we modeled out that frequently cause us trouble, and I'll come back to that. A couple of other things. The cost of testing large number of entities that are interacting is really expensive, because you have to be able to build a large number of entities. And if the physical world is really a little bit different than the simulated world, somehow we have to figure out how to do some of this so we can learn from it. And you know, we really don't like to test near the boundaries of the capabilities of the agents because we have an investment in them, so we don't want to break them. But it's really here that's the place that you learn most of what you need to learn, because that's where the models break down. That's where all the linear behavior goes away. That's where you're right near, oh, I can do it. No, I can't. And so we need to find a way to be willing to make tests that could risk parts of the system and destroy them in order to test our models of devices there and how they interact when they operate there. Okay, so these are my arguments that we need to have test beds. And So I remember, I lived in the mountains, so I was sitting on my back deck one day with a beer thinking about this and saying, you know, I need a vehicle to test. You know what? I can go to the toy store and buy a vehicle for $30. And if I could do that, you know, it's really cheap. It has all the problems of being operated pretty much all the time near its limits because it's really rotten hardware. I wonder how cheap I could make it. Well, so including the drive, drive model and controller, and Zigbee wireless, $75. And then you put sensors on it. So you can choose what sensors you want to drive up the cost. But that includes a microcontroller to handle data processing for everything but video, things like that. You know, they're not real big, so you can kind of store them in a closet. And if you break one, you know, you go out to your local Target and buy another one. And it turns out that I now have two students this year who really productized this and got it down to the point that it takes them about an hour to build and put the sensors on this. Okay. So I think I've gotten to the point that I can test bad hardware, or hardware that's operating at the limits of its behavior, and that I'm not really too worried about breaking because the replacement cost is very low. So I see this as a system that could be driven to larger end, provided I can find a big enough space to run them around and tasks for them to do. Tasks, well, you know, kids learn a lot from playing with toys. So maybe so can I. So there are four tasks that we want to do with these cars. And they've turned out to be really fruitful. Follow the leader means replicate the trajectory of a car that I drive around. Okay. And tag basically then says, all right, you're it, you're not it, go. And so it takes the same trajectory projection capability, but it changes the goals of the two entities, right? Soccer practice, that is, take some group of these cars and get them to bump a ball into a designated goal. And push the box, which is a box which is big enough and irregularly weighted so that no car is successful at doing it itself. So why do we pick these tasks? Well, they are one or few. I claim that none of these reach the category of many. Which I think is a sort of a research challenge I'm working on later. Collaborative or competitive. Asynchronous or synchronous. That is, if the cars bump the ball at different times, that's probably a good thing, but if they push the box at different times, they're not going to succeed. There's another thing that I didn't put on the slides that I think is really important. What the task is and what success means are both describable in common language. And they're pretty easy to measure from video. So they have the potential that by examining video of the system running, you could have a system learn to score, if you will, different approaches or different algorithms. So this is a place where we would like to then have a software system, something that Chris is going to talk more about, where it's really easy to take somebody's idea or somebody's algorithm or method and plug it in and test it against other ones in a way that's easy to measure. And not only that, but easy for other people to understand the results. Because I think that's one of the things that's very important about test beds is we need a shared understanding of what success means and what better and worse means. And, you know, most of us either played with these things or have kids who did. So what did we learn? Well, Well, first of all, let's take soccer grounds. I had a grad student who said, look, I could have a car learn to do a better job of bumping the ball towards the goal or figuring out where to get to it to bump it if I had a good topography model. Because then I could just, you know, use the physics, observe the ball, and I could develop a better model. So I could do some self-modeling. Seemed like a good idea to me, so we started off, and we took it down to, I mean, this got really simple. We let the ball go, tried to shove it in the same direction at the same rate, and got vastly different trajectories at different times. Okay. Yeah. So our self-modeling over, our idea that this should converge to a nice topography model over time just didn't work at all. All right. Well, the ball was light enough that it turned out the breeze blew it around. What is the, this, remember I said we make assumptions? Yeah, we made an assumption. We made an assumption that the wind didn't matter. Okay. And what we found out was the wind was everything. We were mapping the wind, and no wonder it didn't converge. All right, so this is an effect which varies over a long time scale, which was why it took us a while to find. All right, so let's take something else. I had another student who was working on, well, let's figure out how to do the best job of bumping the ball so it will go in the direction I want it to go. Because, you know, I've got a curved bumper, and I've got corners, and, you know, and I don't, these cars don't turn very well because they've got really dumb suspensions. So we made the premise that the only interaction between the ball and the car is a collision. And that's not true either. This actually happened in the guy's master's defense for the first time. So this is the absolute horror of this sort of real world research, right? He'd done it over and over, and it worked just fine. And then he did it for his committee, and all right. Now, you know, and it's amusing, but now wait, this is like a very short time change in the entire assumption that car can make about itself. Worse yet, it turns out, you know, if other cars have primitive video and they're looking for the ball, most of them can't find the ball anymore. So this is not only a single agent failure, this is a very difficult collaborative problem. Actually, this problem turns out to be more interesting than what we were trying to do before. Okay. So, you know, most of the science that we got out of playing with toys is actually about learning all the dumb assumptions that we shouldn't have made. But I think it's an important point here to say this is why you test, right? And now I can go back and I can say, well, I actually know this can happen, but I don't have to tell my system that this can happen. So what does it do? How do I get out of this? Do I put in health monitoring and it can turn its wheels and it can spin and, by the way, this is a front-wheel drive vehicle. So, you know, what are we going to do here? You know, do I have communication? Can I identify myself and where I am and ask somebody else to come help me? How would I know to do that? You know, how do I know that I'm not stuck? How do I know that I'm stuck on the ball? I don't, probably. And so on. So, you know, we've come up with lots of really, I think, fruitful questions just from playing with toys, which is probably a message about those of us who are too serious about our research. So in conclusion, what I'm gonna say is, I think the real world is much more interesting than our models. And that we ought to spend time doing stuff with it. You know, even helping Grandpa out of his chair or picking up his TV remote it's not all that simple. I mean, suppose his TV remote got slid under the chair. And he can't see it. He just wants his TV remote. I have an acquaintance who has ALS, and so she doesn't have enough strength in her arms to actually pick up her arms, but she has enough strength to type on a keyboard. And currently, she has a service dog, because if one of her hands falls off the armrest of her wheelchair, she can't pick it up. And she has a lot of difficulty typing, reaching enough of the keyboard to actually type the commands to do anything at that point. So she has a service dog that's trained to come over and use its nose and put her hand back up on the keyboard. Okay. You know, perhaps we could make assistive devices that do some of those things. You know, a dog can do that, but a dog can't put her lunch in the microwave. Feed her. Really basic things. And so, especially as the population ages, we have a lot of challenges of trying to put assistive devices in environments with people where that interaction is just really poorly defined but critical. At the same time, we're really unforgiving of poor behavior in engineered systems. You know, if Chris forgets my birthday and he says, you know, I was really busy, I just forgot your birthday. I'm sorry. That repairs the interaction. But if my computer forgets my birthday and I told it to remember, it's a failure. And there's not much of a way to repair that. So we have some interesting standards of perfection for engineered systems based upon experience that they're really pretty good. And I think our challenge as engineers is to kind of figure out how to continue to keep that up. In this increasingly interconnected, large collection of devices, programs, and bits. You know, you saw some examples that say getting one agent to do the right thing in the real world is not all that easy. And physics hints, or at least, you know, we see collaboration working really well. But we see some very complicated behavior, and that's my, you know, dilute gas versus fluid dynamics comment. You know, you can have bottom-up things like turbulence that maybe we don't like, and we see examples of that. But we need to start looking at how to expand from, you know, one to a few to really many, and start understanding what restrictions that puts on the interactions of individual agents. You know, nearest neighbor, next nearest neighbor, you know, what kind of communication, what kind of delays, what, yeah, I think there's a whole interesting area here that we're just starting to come into about, you know, you can manage this for a few, but as you start to increase the numbers and the diversity, you know, how do you manage those interactions in a way that continues this organic vision? And therefore, we really need to develop the capability to test them. And to test them near the interesting parts of their behavior where they really get unusual. And of course, none of this would have been done without a lot of other people whom I want to mention and thank.
Yeah, thank you, Chris.
Other questions? There's a term for testing not at the boundaries. It's called happy path testing.
And we do a lot of that.
We see a lot of that. Yes, there's just a course. We tried this and this and this. All happy.
I like that. I haven't heard that before.
About the self-organizing systems, you seem to need lots of elements in order to work properly. So considering the examples you provided, like the grid versus smart grid, or dump traffic control, smart traffic, and so on, we already have these systems. and they do work a certain way. Now, if, say, we knew how to have them self-organize, we still have to go from the current state to the other state all of a sudden, because otherwise it wouldn't work.
Well, I claim that maybe the grid and traffic control are slightly different there, but you do have local structure. So you could, for example, take a town and experiment with a town for traffic control.
Because they're all interconnected. So the grid, for example, if we just have one area that is smart and the rest is not smart, then we have to test for that. And I'm thinking of analogies with nature. It's very rare that a species from a bug becomes a human all of a sudden. Usually a few intermediary species that are also viable, not between the bug and the human. I'm very bad with
Well, I'm not a biologist either.
But there are a few in-between species that are viable that can live as well. So should we also try to study systems that are in between the traditional way and self-organized and they become more
I haven't thought of it that way, but I think that that's probably the practical route. I think what you have is these are systems that have, if you will, computation at very many levels. So they're hierarchical systems, whether it's one robot or whether it's the electrical grid. They're actually rather hierarchical, and so I think you can start with pieces of that hierarchy.
But the pieces have to be able to work on their own.
Yes.
And then the combination has to work on their own.
Yeah.
And then the bigger problem, so we have to have all these steps, and that's,
right.
I haven't seen many works on that at this
point. I absolutely agree. And I think the really challenging one there is the electrical grid. Because the amount of generation and loads and stuff that you need are so distributed and so interconnected that I think that's one of the real grand challenges here. Very good point.
One of the things we have a lot in space, but it's more software systems, is we can describe this wonderfully new system, but unless we describe how we get from where we are to there, nobody pays attention. We have to have that whole process. Now, having lots of little pieces of managed interactions is a way of changing gradually, if you can manage the interactions.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, puzzled by discrepancies that I see between these nice tests of simple robots who are gleeful, they really can avoid collisions, or they can follow each other. These are very simple tasks,
right.
And I have seen these experiments over years.
Right.
And I talk to colleagues, say, and people in the industry, they say, well, within at most five or 8 years, we will have in series production autonomous cars. it will be standard that we will, and they say this is not vision, but this is reality. Within very few years, the first thing will be cars which can drive autonomously to the parking lot in a parking garage, and very shortly after, we will have the vehicles which will drive autonomously, like in these car-to-go examples and so on. You just call the car, it's coming, and you drive, and it drives you where you want, and then you just let it go. This is not vision, but this is something where people are working on at the moment. And I'm wondering how they actually can make statements on the safety of those vehicles. If we have problems with those very simple scenarios.
Yes.
It's much more intelligent.
Probably.
Well,
they are good engineers, somehow there's a huge gap between those different designs.
I agree, and I think one of the things that's always amused me is I think back in the I would say probably back in the 70s there was a bunch of early work on traffic modeling, and people found that that traffic is nicely modeled by hydrodynamic equations, by fluid dynamics. And so the question is, then how smart does a car really have to be? Because, a lot of those interactions are actually sort of nearest neighbor, next nearest neighbor interactions. mean, I think that's part of the message of that kind of model. You know, what it says is, in a sense, that driving, especially in heavy traffic, reduces us to not very many choices. And so the challenge, I think, is actually the mix of humans and driverless cars. I think possibly that driverless cars might be simpler if we just all agreed that they would be autonomous. But I think the real challenge here is to mix this kind of autonomous system into a world where there are humans who, you know, suddenly remember that they forgot they were getting off at this exit and go flying across four lanes of traffic, expecting everybody else to recognize that and accomplish it. You know, and maybe part of this is, you know, we have this expectation of perfection because we've been successful. So I don't know that that's an answer, but I think I share your concern, especially having seen the Caltech DARPA Grand Challenge car and how many servers it had in the back. So I think the, you know, the computational power that people use to do that. And of course, especially because many of these systems are really very top down. And so I think there may be some real interesting opportunities for doing a little bit more local interaction, bottom up approach to this.
Well, a crowd of horses doesn't seem to run into itself very often. They don't seem to run into each other. So all we need is their cars that are smarter than horses, not cars that are smarter than drivers. But the systematic question behind that, you talk one, few, many, yes. And I kept thinking about it, what it really means in terms of runtime system, because for the car, for the single agent in this crowd, it's always myself and a few neighbors.
Yes.
Regardless whether these are 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000. Agents, it's always the same, but somehow we have the feeling and we observe that it makes a difference whether we look at 10 agents or 10,000 agents. So the question is, in terms of runtime system, how does this feedback to the single agent? The single agent acts locally.
Yes.
And how can it know that its local actions have a global effect, which is desirable or not desirable? That it doesn't know, but somehow we have, if we want to solve the problem of controlled emergence, we have to close this feedback loop,
yes,
somehow. Otherwise, it makes no difference whether it's 10,000 or 100,000. So, yeah.
There are some things about anybody who's been driving for a long period of time recognizes a kind of characteristic of traffic. If this traffic is twitchy, there's too much moving around, there's something, they want to go faster than the traffic will allow, or this traffic is nice and smooth, it's like all rush hour drivers, they all know it's going to take a long time, so nobody's trying to do that. And you get a feeling for what the traffic is like. And if that can be measured, that is a kind of emergent measurement.
This is a kind of feedback.
Yes.
Yes. I realize that you have been in Germany last week, and now you're so this
well,
seems to be the
way to get out of the way.
Yeah, you're right. There's an indirect feedback. You can sense a little bit from the behavior of your neighbors what the whole system might be, but I doubt that this is enough. So maybe we would like to have a bird's eye view on the whole system, but we don't have it so far, if it's a local action.
Right.
Just one remark in the power system, we somehow have that, because there you have the frequency signal, which is giving you some kind of global feedback. And you can see it, this is a global signal, so it's the same everywhere. And if you have a disturbance there, then it's felt immediately in all places. Whereas if you have voltage, this is something which is a completely local effect. So there are certain things, certain parameters, if you pay attention to those, you know you're having a global influence. Whereas, or you see the global influence, and for others, you can only see the local influence.
Well, except that I would say that if you have a large change in the reactive power of a load locally, that actually propagates over time full system, and one of the problems is that delay time when you're trying to control the whole system. So I sort of disagree with you that it happens at the same time all over. I agree that, so I think that, that the phase is a little bit like pressure. It's a distributed average property, and there are local variations. And you know, so yes, the average is a measure of the overall operation of the system, but there's a critical timing about that and about using that feedback, because you know, getting the delay wrong means instability instead of stability. And you know, and we see that currently, of course, once in a while.
Yeah. Just one comment. You compare with the model versus test bed. So you say yes, that in the model you make many different assumptions which doesn't reflect the real world problem. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I think model also, I completely agree on that, because the test bed is the one showing the real world scenarios, so you have a problem, it's defined the characteristics. But on the other hand, it is very difficult to release on the code. So you need mm-hmm. a lot of time to do the test bit. But
right.
on the model, you can easily set up some parameter. You can at least verify some of your, some dimension of the assumption that you made. So it's not the, you cannot take this in the real world, definitely not. But it gives you a very fast result. And then you can do another modeling. So I think what I want to say that, yes, I agree, but I think modeling also very important mm-hmm. in order to get the faster result. But obviously,
but
test bed is the...
Yes, but we already do that, and we do a tremendous amount of that, and we do that really well, right?
Yeah,
and it's what Chris said, and a lot of that modeling is that easy path.
Modeling is absolutely necessary, of course, this is the essence of science, but the problem is that our systems are open now, they are not closed systems anymore. And this means that what you were talking about, the assumptions just, that they are open also, and you don't know what you model. Abstraction doesn't work, because abstraction means you just leave out all these peculiarities of the reality. This doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, I think that's the reality. The assumption is the one is very much, how to make the assumption, that's the very important element.
Yeah.
That's the idea.
Yeah. And certainly there's lots of interesting work on using parallel combinations of multiple models at different scales of resolution to try and address some of this. But I think ultimately the problem is, I guess a part of what I'm trying to say is, I think part of the challenge here is that modeling is so natural to us, it's how we work, that we have actually sort of an inflated expectation of its success, because we've learned that it's so successful.
Just a very simple question, I think it's a generic question maybe, not particularly. So I try to understand that the cognitive computing system and the organic computing system. So can you, is it really different, the terminology, or there is something really different? I mean, how do you, can you please, I mean, you are the organizer, so I think there are a lot of also cognitive computing system and organic. So how we differ that thing?
I don't know the definition of the area of cognitive computing systems, but definitely organic systems have to be cognitive, because if I have to characterize an organic system, then we always use the architecture of the observer and the controller. And the observer tells the system certain states of the environment and of itself, and passes this information on to the controller, and the controller derives actions from that. So this is cognition, if you will. Very, very simple, but it is. So
it's not as that simple. So because cognitive systems mission is something usually refers to very complex environments where you have to extract relevant information and so on. The major thing about organic computing is that we are able to adapt to certain events in the environment, but it's all, a certain amount of cognition is necessary. But cognitive science is definitely something which is much broader in some way than organic computing. It's a different aspect that is looking
at. It depends what you're really talking about. Cognitive science in the sense of studying the brain.
This is a totally different cognitive system where we're bringing the cognitive science brain of the like human learning, reasoning, processing in the system. So the cognitive system. That's the we are also a cognitive system.
But then you are concentrating on especially that aspect on cognition. And in computing, we're looking at the system as a whole, not just this one
computer. I would say another thing here, that this has to do a little bit with a focus on achieving certain kinds of behavior actually in applications. And I think one of the things that attracts me in this organic computing community is a focus on actually building stuff in the real world and making it work and deploying it. And therefore there's a certain amount of let's keep it simple. And I think the cognitive approach tends to be let's make more and more complicated ways to model, compare, think about, build tools. And I think that's more to me. I'm not an expert, but the things that I've seen have to do with very large reasoning systems that are modeled, after sort of how we think we think. And I think here the attempt is to simplify, is to try and focus on the pieces that are going to make these interactions work.
Think about intelligent control from way back. That wasn't really an attempt to use intelligence. It was an attempt to use methods that were derived by intelligence to do more interesting controls. And in all, there's probably half a dozen fields that are trying to do the same thing, and making more interesting systems that work in the real world. And you have to pick your analogies from something that's successful. Now, biological systems are basically the only successful complex systems that we know about. Of course, they're ultimately unsuccessful. But the idea is that a whole lot of the cognitive stuff, bio-inspired, neural, all these different methods are sources of analogies for trying to do this. And in that sense, you can limit. I'm not in favor of limiting where I get, where how I cheat at all. So I'll take cognitive methods that they seem to work for my application, or I'll take a neural method, or I'll take some actual mathematical method, some work that I've used for, or something, if I can. But there's dozens of different areas with different names that are trying to do better system building in the world.
Yeah.
So, cognitive is definitely one of those.
Yeah. I have the problem of running late, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. So, Phyllis, thank you. Yeah.